And here we are, side two. Pattern change successful? Let's see, where did we leave off?
Cool summer sounds. Greater Portland sounds. WLOB 1310.
The station was widely listened to in Cuba, especially in Havana, where youngsters used to pick up the signal effortlessly with ordinary radio sets. It was hip to listen to it, and during the late 1970s, when the only form of fun young Cubans had was to gather at a friend's house to dance to American music, generations of high school boys and college students used to keep tab on Casey Kasem's American Top 40 on WQAM. Lee Abrams recalls that things unraveled for WQAM in the early 70s. Most importantly, he said, culture changed dramatically in the late 60s. Moon landings, drug revolution, sexual revolution, riots in the streets, Vietnam. WQAM was so firmly rooted in the middle 60s surf generation that they just couldn't cut through. Add to that the emergence of FM, a new generation of artists that hardly identified with the WQAM era, and many unfortunate internal issues like a strike, firing their kingpin, Rick Shaw, a haircut rule amongst the jocks, and a management force deal where they had to wear these goofy blazers with a happy tiger on them to public appearances. And he said there was a general losing of the vibe. WQAM dominated in the late 50s, then to cut costs, they automated. They died. Then they scrapped the automation in 63 in time for the Beatles invasion, and from 1964 to 1968, they were untouchable. It seemed like an eternity, Abrams said, but to me, that magic was a fleeting four-year year spread. It shows how greatness is fleeting if you don't work at it. In 1980, WQAM tried country, but in the early 1990s, the station added oldies and sports talk, and the country music format was dropped. The oldies music lasted until 93, when the format was changed to all sports, and the station became known as Sports Radio 560. WQAM operates that format full-time on 560, 5 kilowatts day, 1 kilowatt night, non-directionally, from its studios in Hollywood, Florida, still licensed to nearby Miami. Another heritage call is found at 610. That, of course, WIOD, currently operating as a news talker. It appears from old government records that the station was at first confused with WMBF, which stood for Miami Beach, Florida. It's possible there was a timeshare arrangement early on. The WIOD call first appears in 1926. Within a year, WIOD was on 1210, and their records indicate they identified as WIOD-WMBF. Things became clearer a year later. WMBF's authorization was terminated. WIOD ID'd as the Wonderful Isle of Dreams. At the same time, they were moved to 1240 at a kilowatt, then assigned to 560 at 500 watts. An experimental license for nighttime operation at 500 watts gave the feds enough information so they could allow WIOD to do 1 kilowatt day and 500 night. The next frequency change was to 1120. Now they timeshared with WDBO Orlando. This was in 1929. The timeshare didn't make sense. So the next stop for WIOD was 1300, same power levels. Then in 1937, the final move to 610, 1 kilowatt full-time. In 1941, the authorization was expanded to 5 kilowatts full-time, directional night. From 1959 to 1962, the call letters were WCKR. Some of you remember Whacker Radio. They attempted a rock and roll format, but were unsuccessful against strong competition. The WIOD call went to 1360. They played with Top 40 on that channel. We'll talk about that later. The call letters returned to 610 in 1962. Today, WIOD has reportedly one of the largest radio news staffs in the business. It operates in Miami as News Radio 610. That takes us to 670 in Spanish WWFE, allowed on the air on this Clear Channel after the breakup of the Clears. They're 50 kilowatts day and 1,000 at night. They operate the Spanish format as La Ponderosa and feature a diet which includes Cuban music. There's not much known anecdotally about this station, and they don't seem to be a big player on the Spanish scene. On 710, we discover Spanish News Talk WAQI, formatted as Radio Mambí. It came on as WFTL in 1939 on 1370 kilocycles, got to 250 watts, moved to 1400 by Narba. From there came the 1942 jump to one of the 1B channels, 710, with 10 kilowatts directional night, providing, said the feds, they could provide adequate protection to WOR New York. You'll remember back then the 1B channels usually had only three stations. In this case, they were WOR, Miami, and Cairo in Seattle. In 1945, they were known as WGBS, and in 1947, upped the power to 50 kilowatts day, 10 at night directional. And finally, in 1962, came 50,000 watts full-time directional. In 1985, the call letters WAQI appeared. A solid signal toward Cuba allows Radio Martí a voice for an hour of news on WAQI nightly from 12 midnight to 1 a.m. Not sure if this is still happening. Prior to 1985, the station was known as WGBS under the ownership of Storer Broadcasting, going through a number of mainstream adult music and eventually talk formats. This is a coward's way of telling you that there are many, many stories associated with this station and others, but we just don't have time to relate them. But we will take a few moments for fun on 790. WFUN was Miami's legendary Top 40 outlet, going head-to-head with QAM's Tiger Radio. Wiki says that originally the station was located at 800 as a daytimer. While there, it was licensed to Miami Beach and was the first station in the area to hold the WMBM call letters. Then to 1490. In early 1960s, the station migrated down to 790 and went full-time as WFUN. The 790 dial position was a moderately directional signal, despite coverage limitations, especially to the southwest. WFUN competed vigorously with WQAM throughout the 1960s, as we said, and they even won some of the rating sweeps. Because of the emergence of FM in 1976, WFUN abandoned Top 40 for an adult standards MOR format. FUN was used by one of its disc jockeys to create the revolutionary and hybrid Boss radio broadcasting sound of Swinging Radio England, heard from the coast of southern England in 1966. In 1978, 790 was WNWS AM with a news talk format. Popular talk show host Tom Lakis was heard in the early 1980s. In 1990, back to music as WMRZ, 790 Memories. WMRZ switched to a schedule of brokered programming in late 1993, then became WAXY AM in 1994 after the original Waxy on FM abandoned those call letters. They aired an eclectic mix of shows from investors, sports, radio theater, religion, as well as a mixed bag of music shows, including hip-hop, Cajun, Zydeco, oldies, and gospel. Recently, Waxy was 790 the ticket, but our spies tell us there may have been another format change this summer. WACC is next at 8:30, operating Spanish at 1,000 watts, two different patterns. They ID as Radio Paz, Radio Peace. They're an outlet of Pax Catholic Communications. And now to WINZ at 9:40. Wins on as a 1 kilowatt daytimer in 1946 with the call WFVL. However, an early challenge from WFTL as to market confusion caused the call change to WINZ. They quickly built out their facilities. Within a year, they were full-time with a nighttime directional. Then in 1951 came the license for 50 kilowatts day, 10 at night, with two different patterns. Today, the WINZ daytime signal reaches as far north as Fort Pierce, as far west as Fort Myers in Naples, and as far south as the Bahamas. The station has managed to score ratings in the Fort Myers, Naples, and West Palm Beach, Boca Raton markets, despite its tower being over 100 miles away. During the early 1960s, WINZ competed with Top 40 powerhouses WQAM and WFUM. Personalities included Bruce Morrow, who was heard there during 1960, but who then returned to his hometown of New York and began a long run at WABC the following year as Cousin Brucey. In the 90s, WINZ was 940 Fox Sports Radio, competing with WQAM and, in this case, WAFN. In 2004, the station signed on in a liberal talk format. Then in 2009, the format shifted back to sports, and Wins is now known as the sports animal. And thus, part one of our State of the Stations in Miami, Fred's got the hook out, and he's stomping his foot there in the sheetrock control booth, so I think we better get out of the way. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service will put the wrap to the State of the Stations Miami next month. Until then, good listening, DXers.
The Musers.
Hello, fellow DXers. Wayne Ryan in Brantford, Ontario. CFRA in Ottawa, 580, has 30,000 watts nighttime power now, and it's coming up here more nights. Charleston, West Virginia is usually what comes in at night, 50,000 watts WCHS. In the daytime, we usually get CKWW in Windsor. Well, now that the solar flares are supposed to be over, and hopefully they are, I'm able to get KDKA Pittsburgh in the daytime again. I had WBAL Baltimore this morning at about 20 to 10 Eastern time. And WPHT Philadelphia is staying up, too. And many a morning, I'm still getting WBBR out of New York about 8 o'clock, KMOX St. Louis, and WOWO in Fort Wayne. Well, I just got the news last night, which was Wednesday, October the 10th, that 710 CJRN in Niagara Falls, Ontario, is going to be put off the air. They have until Friday, November the 30th to do so. The Canadian Radio and Television Commission has rendered this decision because, as they put it, and I know this to be true because I only live 69 miles from it, they don't give any local news, weather, or sports, nothing but tourist information. Well, I think there's airport radio stations that give you that, so that'll open up 710. WOR will come up here better of a night. Maybe we'll have even better chances to get WLW Cincinnati up here in the daytime. CBEF, which is on 540 and has been for a long time, that's the CBC's French station in Windsor, is going to 1550, where CBE used to be in English with 10,000 watts. And I don't know what will go on 540, but that will open it up. I know we have a very big station out in Watrous, Saskatchewan, CVK, that has been on that frequency for a long time, and it may give us an opportunity to pick up that station again.
Hi, this is Audrey in New York. Hope everyone's well, and happy upcoming holidays. I'm calling to talk about what's going on. People are, you know, musing about the format changes, but in my profession, I do a lot of reading, and what's happening is, Fred, if you would like to do some articles about the three major or the major players, Clear Channel and Merlin and CBS, and how they're buying and selling radio stations. And what's mainly happening is FM is starting to duplicate AM because there are lots more music choices happening, like Pandora and online services that are taking over where FM left off, kind of thing. And a lot of sports stations want to duplicate their formats on FM. For example, here in New York City, 98.7, which was once an urban station, has now folded into the other. It used to be competitor. And ESPN sold out to that frequency, so they duplicate at 1050 AM and 98.7 FM. And then also I just read that Merlin Media sold a station to CBS Radio for $75 million, if I read it correctly, taking their station frequency at 101.9, which used to be news, the first FM news station, and flopped, became a rock station again, and will probably duplicate one of the sports, I believe WFAN, from what I read, if I read it correctly, or if they didn't lie and don't change their mind later. So that's what's happening around the country. It seems to be happening in Philly, and I think Mike Lance mentioned something about Miami. So you might want to do some more in-depth coverage in one of the articles that you read at the end or something. Okay, have a nice holiday, and happy DXing to everyone.
Good morning, everyone. It's October 22nd. This is Joe Schwab from Fredericksburg, Virginia, with a couple of items of interest. First of all, 1260 WWRC in Washington is now simulcasting with 1250 in Warrenton. I believe the call letters are WKNV. I'm not sure of those call letters, but anyway, that's happening. Apparently, they're both owned by Salem Communications. And the other thing is there's been a slight change in format on 1580, WNEW AM is now referring it to itself as biz.gov radio, and they're having programming from Bloomberg during the middle of the morning, and they run the Clark Howard show in the afternoon, so that's a couple of items for you. Also, the station in Bishopville on 1360 is actually on 1380, and you pronounce that town in South Carolina St. Stephens, like the name Stephen. So if it ever comes up again, we'll know how to say that. Also, I was wondering what the situation is formatically on 1370. I can't pick them up at all since their call letter changed. That's 1370 in the Baltimore area. I was wondering what they were doing. There's a country station on 1370 in Tabor City, North Carolina. It used to be a daytime-only station, but they're staying on at night. So if you hear country music on 1370, that's what you'll be getting. Also, WWIP on 610 in Philadelphia is simulcasting with their FM. They're running a sports format. And finally, Rush Limbaugh is going to begin broadcasting on WSB in Atlanta on October the 29th. That's a bombshell I never thought would happen. Think how long he's been on, and now he's finally getting on WSB, so you have to wonder what station he was on before and what that did formatically to help that to happen. Anyway, that's all for now. 73s and good DXing, everyone.
And that is our musings to the members on this edition of the DX Audio Service. If you're a National Radio Club member of the DX Audio Service, or EDXN, you can give us a call at area code 419-741-0205. And that's 24 hours a day for DX Audio Service and EDXN members. And keep it brief and to the point. We would prefer under 2 minutes per member per month. That way everyone has a chance to speak, and also keep it brief and to the point on the subject of radio and information about radio. To answer a few questions, 710 CJRN and 540 CBEF. Wayne, I think those will probably go to the wayside, and we won't hear anything on those. I could be surprised by maybe an application for a 540 somewhere over in the Western Ontario region, because that frequency is fairly open in the area. I've always been surprised that Canada has never given up the 710 frequency for somewhere like in southeastern Michigan or so, but they're still holding on to that frequency, and I imagine they'll hold on to 540 as well. Audrey, on format changes and information, we'd love to hear from you on that. If you could send us some articles or some tips on some articles, we'll be sure to publish them here in the magazine. And we're hearing a lot about duplication of AM on FM. It seemed that in the old days, a lot of AM stations would put their signal on FM, basically to promote the FM. But now it seems like it's being done because more listeners are on FM than on AM. But as I dial across the AM band, it seems like it's a vast wasteland of nothing but sports talk and news talk these days. I've only caught a few interesting music stations, so I wish that that part of the format would change, that they'd have more interesting stuff on AM other than just sports talk and news talk. But we shall see. Now let's do some news and information. Blind Entrepreneur Rolls Out Radio Business by David Gunner. Dwayne Miller explains the finer points of a radio product to Sherry Maxwell, vocational rehabilitation counselor for the Idaho Commission for the Blind and Visually Impaired. On the phone, Dwayne Miller's voice has all the resonance and distinctive character of a radio announcer. Not surprisingly, really, since he spent some time in the broadcast booth and on the air. These days, Miller's involvement in the radio world is focused on selling CB and amateur ham radio equipment and accessories. When potential customers call his home-based business, they get an expert counsel, with that broadcaster's voice at no extra charge, from a man who can get them set up with the right kind of system or help them troubleshoot just about any kind of radio-related issue. He says, "And all the time they're talking to me, they have no idea that I'm blind. until they meet me, Miller said. It's funny because if they did know, they might think, hey, this guy's blind. He doesn't know anything. Blindness is a stigma that business owners such as Miller have to constantly overcome. In his case, as in the case of hundreds of other Idahoans, every year, the Idaho Commission for the Blind and Visually Impaired provides training and assistance to land a job or to turn a good idea into an active enterprise. My job with Duane, as well as with other clients, is to get them to work, said Sherry Maxwell, who is a vocational rehabilitation counselor for ICBVI in Idaho. As an agency, we work with about 150 blind people a year in the five northern counties. We put about 67 blind people in the state back to work, and 17 of them were in northern Idaho. In this region, training and placement programs have continued to thrive, even in an economic downturn, she added. North Idaho is the agency's most productive area in the state, the counselor said, and this has already been our most successful year yet. She called out Miller's situation as a ready-made success story. Sitting in his dining room, Maxwell puzzled him about the items that he keeps in stock. Dropping right into the business mode, he turns around and, as easily as a sighted person, begins to hold up boxes and outline the benefits of the Cobra and the Uniden radios that he carries, as well as Wilson CB antennas displayed behind him. Along with new and used CB radios, amateur radios, and antennas, Miller sells microphones, coaxial cable, and accessories. With his initial inventory funded by ICBVI as part of the training and the placement process. To get to this point, Miller was required to leave his wife, Chrissy, and 4-year-old daughter, Amanda, for a period of about 10 weeks as he traveled to attend vocational classes at the agency's Adjustment and Training Center in Boise. Attendees live in dorms and take part in daily routines that consist of mobility training, computer courses, and classes in using Braille and career guidance counseling. According to Maxwell, Idaho excels in the area of client choice when it comes to finding employment for the blind. Miller is a believer in the program, more so now than when he started to get traction for his startup business. Some people have a major disability and don't have to work, but I wanted to do something, he said. I went down and I talked to Sherry and she says, we're going to make this happen. There are a lot of blind people who can just work and run their own business, he went on. There are a lot of people that are like me, who just want to get out and go to work instead of griping about it. There are so many things to do. The agency's placement record for the blind and visually impaired clients includes construction workers and roofers, Harley-Davidson mechanics, medical specialists, restaurant staff, retail clerks, and U.S. Forest Service employees. Other individuals have opened their own businesses, including licensed massage therapists, landscapers, accountants, and financial managers, or sales and service ventures like Miller's. There's always an option there, and always an opportunity for those who are willing to put forth the effort, he said. If you can't find a job going to work for somebody else, you can always start your own business.
From the Radio Survivor Newsletter, NAB debating the future life or death of AM radio. Posted on October 4th by Paul Riesmandel. Inside the radio industry, there has been quite a bit of hand-wringing about the AM dial, though conservative talk stations and sports stations in big markets continue to generate ratings and revenue. There's an increasing recognition that other AM stations aren't doing as well. Many blame overcrowding on the dial, which leads to more interference, especially at night. Others claim broadcasters themselves are to blame for not maintaining facilities and for uncreative programming. Over at DIYmedia.net, John Anderson takes a critical overview of the solutions being examined by the National Association of Broadcasters, which has formed a task force to tackle the future of AM. John writes, "The task force seems to be considering two primary ideas for revitalizing AM. One is to phase it out completely and migrate all AM stations to new spots on the FM dial. The other involves a wholesale conversion of AM broadcasting from analog to digital, using AM HDiBoc as the mechanism. Neither of these proposals are optimal. Both would necessitate listeners buying new receivers to take advantage of any changes, and they would be expensive and disruptive to all AM broadcasters, many of whom are on shaky financial footing already. The NAB is the handmaiden of the largest broadcast conglomerates, and with the close cooperation of National Public Radio, seems to be leaning toward the all-digitalization route. Either will be a tough sell. John Anderson at DIY Media. Rizmondel continues, I tend to come down on the side of thinking that the big broadcasters made their own bed, similar to how Clear Channel and its ilk squeezed the life out of commercial music radio on FM over the last 16 years. Just like HD radio has failed to rescue FM, I have serious doubts that digitizing AM will save it either. I also don't agree with scrapping AM. Although it is an older technology, which poses technical and fidelity challenges that FM does not face, it also has distinct advantages. First, AM transmissions can cover a much bigger geographic area than FM, nearly half the North American continent with the right power level. Because they don't travel line of sight, it's easier to send and receive AM signals in hilly or mountainous areas than it is FM. Second, AM receivers are simple to build and operate. A crystal set doesn't even need batteries. While this may seem downright antiquated in the mobile internet age, it can be a real lifesaver during a natural disaster or other emergency that results in extended power outages. Finally, the infrastructure is already there and is in use. There are still millions of listeners tuning into AM radio each day who would likely lose many of their favorite stations were the service eliminated. Furthermore, the AM broadcast band is a tiny swath of spectrum, not particularly useful for data services like the FM and UHF bands are. Of course, any change would require a long FCC proceeding. But that doesn't mean change is necessarily unlikely or impossible. What it means is that those of us who care about preserving the AM service need to be aware and ready to engage in the debate. And that's an article entitled NAB Debating the Future Life or Death of AM Radio in Radio Survivor Newsletter, written by Paul Rizmondel. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service.
Should the Federal Communications Commission license 250-watt low-power FM stations? What about 10-watt stations? That debate is beginning to get traction as the industry has more time to digest the Commission's decisions earlier this week on low-power FM and FM translators, as well as the agency's additional proposals. Right now, there are two classes of LPFMs, 100 watts and 10 watts. Though the Federal Communications Commission has only issued construction permits and licenses for LP100 stations. In its latest notice of proposed rulemaking on LPFM, the agency has asked for public input on whether the LP10 class should be eliminated without much explanation. It's also asking whether higher power stations at 250 watts should be approved for rural areas that are not as spectrum challenged as urban areas. Both the Amherst Alliance and the Catholic Radio Association favor licensing LP 250 watt stations. When Radio World asked for comments on the issue, Don Schullenhardt and Nick Leggett, the two original co-petitioners who got the ball rolling on LPFM licensing at the Commission, said they favor licensing 250-watt LPFMs in rural areas and retaining the LP10 in urban areas. On the whole, they're happy with the proposals and say that the timing of the Commission's actions this week, odds are good that the agency can meet the goal of opening the LPFM filing window later this year. The potential 10-watt eliminations gives them pause, however. Speaking as individuals, Schlunhart and Leggert told Radio World magazine that losing the LP-10s would close the option of stretching scarce spectrum over more urban LP-FM stations by reducing the wattage of that typical station. Due to much higher population density, and therefore much larger potential audiences per square mile, an urban FM station can survive financially at 10 watts. In an extreme case, even at 1 watt, although this wattage could bankrupt an LPFM in a small town. The two cite analysis by Common Frequency and REC Networks, for example, in which they say that it shows the New York City area can't accommodate any LP100 stations at all, but it can permit allocation of one LP10. By this same analysis, Los Angeles could fit in only one LP100 station, but it'd be able to accommodate five LP10 stations, and San Francisco can accommodate two LP100s, but could also fit in five LP10 stations. Schlunhart and Leggert urged the commission to explain the reasoning behind the potential elimination of LP10 classes of service, noting that when the agency opened the first LPFM filing window more than a decade ago, it said LP100s would be licensed first, and then 10-watt stations would be licensed later.
Classic love songs.
Welcome to Saturday.
Stand by for a 60s Music Sweep.
If you do voiceovers or know somebody who does voiceovers for commercials and radio stations, you might want to know about the Voiceover Wars. This article appeared in the Los Angeles Times and was written by Joe Flint. Old taboos don't apply as celebrities now encroach on once sacred turf. Tom Kane hates the ads for Mercedes-Benz. It's not the car, it's John Hamm. Mercedes uses the Mad Men star as the voice of its television and radio commercials. Even if it's a terrific spot, which it isn't, people don't have a clue who that is, said Kane, a professional voiceover actor who's done animation, movie trailers, and commercials for at least two decades. As brand name advertisers fight for the attention in a cluttered media landscape, they are turning increasingly to celebrities such as Robert Downey Jr., that's the voice of Nissan, Jeff Bridges, who does Hyundai, and Tim Allen, who does Chevrolet, to pitch their products. It takes more to get people's attention, and the use of celebrities does allow marketers to permeate that clutter better than with the use of a non-celebrity, said Drew Slavin, a general manager of the marketing arm of Mercedes-Benz. Even actors such as Hamm, Allison Janney, the West Wing co-star who pitches Kaiser Permanente, and John Krasinski, the Office star who hawks e-insurance, whose voices might not be recognizable without their face attached, are getting into the act. So are Modern Family co-star Ty Burrell, comedian Wanda Sachs, 24 star and second-generation voice actor Kiefer Sutherland, and Grey's Anatomy veteran Patrick Dempsey. Some are fabulous, and some are pretty, mediocre, said Carrie Tomlinson, a veteran voice actress. The unfortunate thing for us is that the career voiceover actors are not afforded the luxury of mediocrity. For stars, it's a lucrative payday at a time of belt-tightening across Hollywood. For Madison Avenue, it's a way to tap into the nation's celebrity obsession and associate them with the glamour of Hollywood. But for Kane and other voiceover professionals, it's money out of their pockets. They're not happy campers, said Maurice Tobias, a well-known voice coach known in the industry as Voice Whisperer. A lot of them will say, why don't they just leave our business alone? For decades, most of the A-list actors did just that. The occasional big star voiced commercials. Jack Lemmon spoke for Honda. And Gene Hackman was the sound of United Airlines. James Earl Jones did CNN. Donald Sutherland did Volvo. But they were mostly exceptions. Most actors feared being tagged as a sellout or looking desperate to do commercial work. Back then, celebrities didn't do commercials, said Jeff Danis, president of DPN Talent, an agency specializing in voiceover work. Today, the whole landscape has changed, and actors traverse every medium. The taboos aren't there as they once were. Commercials are the latest arena in which television and movie stars are crowding out voiceover professionals. Most major documentaries use big screen or television talent. Think Morgan Freeman in the hit film March of the Penguins. Big parts in an animated movie go to almost exclusively recognizable actors. Tom Hanks in Toy Story. Or Mike Myers in Shrek, in part because the stars can market the movies in ways that unknowns can't. A celebrity is more likely to get his butt on every talk show couch, said Matthew John Beck, casting director who specializes in feature animations. Voiceover work is also an easy way for actors to supplement their income. Actors on every level want to do voiceover work, said Tom Curtis, who specializes in celebrity endorsements with the agency WME. It's a fun thing for them to do. It doesn't take them much time, and it can really be lucrative. Indeed, it can. A celebrity voice easily costs seven figures, according to agents, advertising executives, and veteran voice actors. Celebrities can get a couple million for a commercial that a journeyman might just get $3,000 or $5,000 for, said Bo Weaver, who is a veteran voice actor who credits include the campaigns for Starbucks and El Pollo Loco. Advertisers don't mind shelling out more because they think being associated with a star benefits their brand. It's kind of like paying a little more for a shirt, said Robert Schwartz, chief creative officer at Xiaodé, who clients include Nissan and Visa, and whose ads feature Freeman's voice. Downey's got charisma, and it's exciting Morgan with his great storytelling. He could read the phone book and you'd just fall in love with him. There is a debate whether having a celebrity voice actually helps sell a product or is just a status symbol for advertisers. Is there a way of telling if the extra $1.5 million you paid for Kevin Spacey moved more cars than if you just used a lesser-known voice? Said Maurice LaMarche, who provides voiceovers for Lexus commercials. Marketers counter that using a celebrity voice is just not about moving product. Rarely, it's strictly for sales, says David Schwab of Octagon, a sponsoring consulting firm. Brands are always looking for a way to create product differences, using celebrity voices as increased awareness. That's a complete load of hogwash, Kane said. The reason agency people and clients will shell out millions is called Star You Know What.
Get the happy difference. La 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 la. Get the happy difference. La 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 la. It's in the air everywhere. Radio KGW. The station with the happy difference.
I wanted to take a minute and a half of your time and your attention. The National Radio Club has been on the air for three quarters of a century. Its success is derived from member contributions at all levels. And while many of us prefer to take a passive role, I can tell you from personal experience what fun it is when you can share your work. I do it every month right here. Some of you regularly contribute via the Musings line, and we thank you. But you're only about 15 folks out of a much larger listenership. Over on EDXN, the same thing happens. Members want things like musings, but no one wants to take the time to contribute. So you say, hey, I paid for a subscription, what else do you want? Well, the fact is that your subscription fee covers our production and mailing costs, and the club tries to break even. But the makeup of EDXN and the DX Audio Service continues to be the work of just a few. So if you want more content, you have to help us. So let's try to change that together. You said in your survey responses that you did want more. I have a friend who likes to say, don't get irritated, get involved. Get involved by making your first musings call or by calling again after a long silence. Get involved by telling your friends what great service you get from the DXAS. Get involved by sending Phil Wayne radio air check material for MarketScope. Send news stories about radio to Fred and band scans to me. That's how you can get involved. And by your active help and contributions, we'll get to be an even better club. We look forward to hearing more from you. Together, we can continue to add freshness and variety to the magazines. Do it! Trust me, you'll enjoy sharing your contributions with the rest of us. Thanks, and have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Mark, and I'd like to do a shameless plug at this time for the National Radio Club's Publication Center. It's getting close to the holiday, and you know that you might want something for your DX hobby, or you might know a DXer friend of yours that would love to have something like this. How about the National Radio Club's AM Radio Log? You know, it's the 33rd edition. And the new National Radio Club AM Radio Log is simply the most comprehensive listing of AM stations in the United States and Canada. It's current to this DX season. And if you listen to Dave Alpert do the AM switch and you make your corrections in your log is never, ever more than 30 days old. It's the most comprehensive copy available, even better than the FCC's own website, believe me. It's good information to have. $22.95 to National Radio Club members, $28.95 to non-members, $32 to Canada, that's via Global Priority Mail, $36 outside North America. The FM Atlas 21st edition is closing out. This is Bruce Elving's book that he published for so many years. The remaining copies of the final edition are available from the National Radio Club's Publication Center. It's $15 postpaid to U.S. addressees or $18.50 to Canadian addressees. The quantity is very limited. Only a few more books are available. So if you want one, you better get it now before they are G-O-N-E gone. The National Radio Club's antenna pattern book is gone. That's the sixth edition. It is sold completely out. A seventh edition will be forthcoming, but we don't have details on when it will be available. If you know somebody who's into towers, or maybe you're into towers, you might want to know about National Radio Club member Scott Feibusch's annual Tower Calendar. This one's for 2013, obviously, and it's ready for order. $18.50 plus tax for New York addressees. You can order it via www.fybush.com. And hopefully we'll have some more details on our next edition of what stations you'll have pictures of their tower sites. I've got a cassette sale going on here at the DX Audio Service because, as you know, we're getting out of the cassette business and going strictly to CDs after the first of the year. We have a lot of cassettes just hanging around the studio that I would like to get rid of. Many are blank, and maybe some have some content on them which have been transferred to digital. I'd like to find a new home for these cassettes. If you still have a use for cassettes and you want a large quantity of them, please contact me. A large Priority Mail box of, about 23 inches by 11 inches by 3 inches would be about $16. A medium box, 11 inches by 5.5 inches, is about $12. If you want a lot of tapes, Well, we can probably cut you one heck of a deal. You can contact me here at the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service via email at FVOBE at realoldiesradio.com or by letter to the address at the start of your tape. If you want to do a phone call, that's fine. Just serious inquiries only on the tapes. First come, first serve. I'd like to move them all out of here. Also, we're going to be selling albums. The albums like you can put your cassettes in, and also the duplicator, which we use for making the tapes, is going to be put on sale right after the first of the year. So if you're interested in doing some cassette publishing, you might want to consider making a deal with the club to purchase the duplicator and all remaining stock of labels and boxes, etc. That's it for this edition of the DX Audio Service. Don't forget that on our next edition, you can leave your holiday wishes for your DX friends on the Musings line. We'll see you in 30 days in December. 73, everyone.